So please feel invited to make yourself comfortable for listening. And as I said yesterday, if I use a word that doesn't immediately make sense to you, then do ask me to pick another one that might be more helpful. And yeah, let's kind of explore some Dharma together, some reflections on these teachings and practices which we've been bringing into being today. Yeah, it's what we're doing is what these practices and what these teachings are for, bringing us into connection with our experience. And what I'd like to share this evening, I'd like to begin with just mentioning a little bit from, do you know this sutta? It's probably one of the more famous ones, sometimes referred to something like setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And if you don't know it by that title, it's the one that has the Four Noble Truths in it. Yeah, it has a description of this time where the Buddha kind of lays out these Four Noble Truths. And I know that some people in this hall have kind of been around this scene for a long time, and they might hear something like, oh no, we're going to talk about these Four Noble Truths again. You know, please no, don't do that. So luckily, no, actually I'm not really going to talk about them that much. Because what's quite interesting for me is what's taking place in this second paragraph of these teachings. So that's before we get to the place where these Four Noble Truths are explored. And if you don't know the Four Noble Truths, they're part of the Buddha's Greatest Hits album, and you should definitely check them out. They're not just thrown around because they've become famous. They really are a really fantastic tune with really meaningful lyrics that actually kind of changes your life forever if you get to really understand it. So the first paragraph is just setting the scene. Where are we? We happen to be in the Deer Park in Sarnath, and maybe some of you have also been there or been somewhere like it. And of course, this is thousands of years ago. If you go there now, it's probably not quite the same. But there they were, sitting there, and then the Buddha starts to speak. And this is a translation of what he says. There are these two extremes, yeah, the real extreme edges. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? So these two extremes of behavior, yeah, he's talking about. And one who's gone forth, one who wishes to practice for liberation, for freedom, for well-being. And what are these two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. So sensual, of the senses, yeah, towards sensual objects, like things that bring us pleasure, like seeking happiness through getting and getting rid of things. That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects is base, vulgar, common, ignoble and unprofitable. Okay, so translators like to use very complex words, but what it basically means is it doesn't support you, and it's to do with our more kind of animal nature. Yeah, it's not our best of our humanity. Yeah, but it's also very understandable that we would do that, and perhaps we've been doing that today. Yeah. Wanting to have a nice sitting, wanting to have a delicious meal, yeah. Wanting the sun to shine on me, not the wind and the clouds or dampness. Yeah. Wanting to be warm, not cold. But this is an extreme. It probably doesn't feel like an extreme, but this is what the Buddha is trying to point out with. This is actually the behavior of an extremist. only wants pleasure, don't want any pain. Yeah, I only want one half of the deal of existence, the good stuff. Okay? It does sound a bit extreme. And that's kind of how we live much of the time. So what's this other extreme? That which is devoted to self-affliction. So affliction is harming. That which is addicted to harming itself. Kind of a weird thing to point out. We're not into harming ourselves. We just mentioned, we just want the pleasant. You know, we just want the pleasurable. We don't want the painful. But what's this other extreme? It's really the other side. Do we do that? Have you done that today? Have you put yourself down today? Have you told yourself you're rubbish today? You can't meditate, not with this mind, not with this body. Oh, it's impossible for you. Everyone else, look at everyone else. They're doing it. You, just hopeless heap of self-affliction. Do we do that? Okay, so it's really interesting. He just lays it out for us. And at first you might think, no, I'm not a pleasure seeker, or I don't do self-affliction. But we can slightly taste that it's in us to want to do that. And this self-affliction is painful. Ignoble, unprofitable. So this word he's used twice here, unprofitable and also ignoble. So ignoble, so noble is a sense of someone who, maybe they're like royal, or they're like really of a very high quality of being. And he's not referring to their inherited kind of position in the world. They're actually talking about a way of behaving, which that when people see you behaving that way, it kind of gains respect, brings you that quality of, wow, this is a worthy person to be with. Yeah? And we know that. When we sense that in someone, it's not because they're cool or because they dress the right way or that they have money. It's like something resonates with them. And this is the quality that the Buddha's asking us to seek to find in ourselves. And unprofitable. You know, lots of businesses run on profit and loss. Yeah. Are you going to make something with yourself? So what's that talking about? Profit of what? Profit of well-being. Are you capable of actually being the source for your own happiness? This is what these teachings are kind of drawing us towards. Do we need to get and get rid of things on this level of sensual pleasures, pleasing to the senses? Yeah. Do we need to compare ourselves unfavorably with others to motivate ourselves to do better? Yeah. Like maybe that can work somewhat, but it's not the most productive way of relating to ourselves. Yeah, it's much better to be able to speak to ourselves in supportive ways. How would you say many of the things you may have said to yourself today to another person? Or would you just feel like, no, I've really become like a bad person? Yeah, no. I keep saying this kind of stuff to someone. I need to check that. We need to check the way we talk to ourselves. We undertake this precept to not use speech in divisive ways, yeah? And then we take on this oath here that we're going to go into silence. Yeah, we're not going to speak to someone else. So maybe it doesn't matter for me, this precept. But speaking continues, yeah? You've been listening to yourself speaking all day. Is there a way that we can speak to ourselves that's actually going to free us? And so this is a teaching where the Buddha is referring to the middle way between these extremes. So there are these two extremes, avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, which is the name the Buddha gave to himself, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. Some really kind of beautiful language, just to kind of unpack it a bit, translate it a bit, make it more coarse than it's kind of very beautifully written, but just to make sure that we really understand it. So this calm, we know calm. We know agitation and we know calm. Direct knowledge, knowing for oneself, not a theory. We can actually explore it for ourselves, that there's a middle way between these extremes. We can find our way to there. And to self-awakening, to bringing oneself out of the dream, to bringing oneself more into a vivid life, a more living life, a more clear, bright, present life. And have you noticed, just with the amount of mindfulness that we can create through the 24 hours of, or more now, of a kind of silent practice, that this meal we're eating, it's more vivid, more alive. The colors in this room, more bright. It's like some kind of scales are falling away from the eyes, and from the ears, from the senses, that we're opening that sensibility. And then this quality of unbinding, that which has been bound up, wrapped up, tied down, unbinded, set free. Yeah. Our hearts are something that's bound, wrapped up, protected, kept away from the world. It's not safe out there, it's that feeling. Be unbound. A greater range, a greater possibility of where we can go to, what we can live with, how we can be. And so we know in the next paragraphs the Buddha's going to explore, he's not just going to put out this stall. We know that he's going to go into the Four Noble Truths and explain that this is the path, that this is the understanding, this is the exploration that's going to support us to do this. But first of all, he skips all the theory. Maybe there were some people there whose ears were ready to hear. And he just says, what is the way there? The middle way is just this, the Noble Eightfold Path. And then he lays out, this is what to do. This is what to do. And we'll get there, but what that path gives a sense of is that all of our life is actually path material. All of our life is to be met well, brought towards self-awakening, brought towards unbinding. What's that going to look like? Just seeing if we're one of those people who maybe it could just touch us from there. Do we need the whole unpacking, the whole theory, how it goes together, Four Noble Truths? Is there a sense? There's a sense I could meet my life away from these extremes. One of the core principles that we're going to get to is a quality called tanha, which in the next paragraphs the Buddha is going to expound as what's called a co-arising factor for dukkha. And then people know the word dukkha, And we could say it's this very, very wide range of things which feel hard to be with. They are when we're out of harmony with existence, dis-ease, stress, suffering, unsatisfactory. when we're feeling those kinds of feelings. Why do we end up feeling those kind of feelings? Because of this thing called tanha. And tanha, which is literally a thirst, we could say it's also a sense of not enough, not good enough. Have people heard of this guy who climbed, what was he called? El Capitan in Yosemite Park, Alex Honnold. Yeah, he free climbed it without ropes, went up this enormous flat looking rock. A really kind of remarkable thing to do, which if you're interested in like, what is going on with human beings, it also kind of leaves you with quite a few questions of like, what's up with this guy? Like, why climbing it with a rope isn't exciting enough anymore, or what's going on? But it's also a really remarkable feat of samadhi, of really like focus and attention and climbing, and he's fully there in this moment. It's a beautiful exhibit of kind of mindfulness and planning and preparation, seeing through fear so that he can operate very efficiently and productively, profitably. But there's a documentary about him, which is maybe where people have seen this, and there's a really powerful scene where he's just kind of talking. He's not psychoanalyzing himself, but he mentions his mother. And he mentions that his mother had this phrase, which was, good enough isn't. As in, good enough is not good enough. Yeah, you've always got to get more. Yeah, don't settle. Don't be satisfied. And I remember when I heard that being said, it kind of broke my heart a bit, you know, to kind of hear this sentiment, you know. And partly because I feel like that would be quite a difficult environment to remain sensitive in, you know, and to really kind of be able to fail. But I might be wrong, you know, maybe it was a really kind of wholesome quality. But I also associate it with an aspect in myself and an aspect in all human beings, that we're kind of endlessly dissatisfied. Yeah, we can't actually stay with the good. There's a wonderful teacher who came up with this idea, Rick Hansen is his name, who came up with this idea that good experiences are like Teflon in our mind. You know, Teflon, this thing we put on the non-stick frying pan. Good experiences just slide off, water off a duck's back, they also say. And negative experiences are like Velcro. You know, we can notice that tendency. And it's that same tendency, it's not good enough. What else can I get? Is there something more? You can see it in our minds. Actually, is the breath enough? I keep quoting people, but there's this lovely Zen monk, Palmo something. I can't remember his name, it's a shame. And he has this thing, he says, when you go into a shop or when you feel the urge to buy something, just pause and just check if breathing is enough. Really wonderful kind of anti-consumerist thing. But like, just check. Actually, do you want another thing? Do you want to be carrying something home with you? Or are you actually already okay? Yeah, this is the middle way. We overlook it, yeah? Also, Thich Nhat Hanh has this wonderful saying about you know, Jesus walking on water. It's like, well, it's a miracle, but so is walking. You know, just walking is a miracle. It's like, isn't that amazing? You know, you can just, before you fall over, quickly pull the foot in and then, whoa, again. You don't even need to, you know, do your Michael Jackson backward walking or anything else, just to be able to move ourselves from one location to the other. And yet we overlook these kind of miracles. So one way of looking at our experience, and I'm not saying this is enlightenment, yeah, but one way of looking is, this is good enough. Just to calm down that energy, you know, that habitual energy that's not good enough, that's kind of leading us to further and further inequality in the world. Yeah? Rich countries are inhabited by people feeling like they haven't got enough. Crazy. Have to check this. Yeah? People who've got everything they need are living lives where we're going to destroy the planet. We have to watch out for this tendency. But we also have to understand it's optional. And this is what the Buddha was saying way back there. Watch out for the extremes. You don't feel like an extremist, but you're living like one. Once you get to taste the middle way, this middle way. And it's born in this tanha. It's not good enough. This demand. Good things shouldn't leave me. Bad things shouldn't come to me. I should be perfect. Yeah? These perspectives. Things that we can soften. Okay? They're shared. Shared humanly. Shared. But they're not like a thing we have to be. It's not beyond options how we live. So we can see if there's ways to pull back towards the middleness. You know, there can just be very small tweaks that we can do, like seeing gratitude. You know, gratitude to be able to breathe, gratitude to be able to walk, gratitude to be able to take a retreat. And what a luxury this is. And also, if my mind brings up the idea of getting something, I like to play with the fact, okay, the mind's been creative, it's come up with something to get. But then we just flip it round a little bit, and it's something I have to give away. If it's something worth having, wouldn't it be worth giving it to someone else? And we spoke yesterday about this idea that, you know, this is my plate of food. You know, it's very recently come from the pots. Yeah. Only seconds ago, it wasn't even food I knew anything about, and now it's my food. And then everyone else has my food. Everyone's a my food, and they put it down. It's a very weird concept. We're actually all enjoying the same food. You know, the people in the kitchen who made this for us, you know, really see it that way. The kitchen managers and the kitchen yogis, they know it's our food, and they can appreciate something that we could miss. And it's a shared experience. And so the generosity for them is they get to enjoy all of us enjoying our food. Yeah, it's not an opportunity to be missed. So there's a sense of generosity, but there's also a sense of the generosity of opening our perspective, yeah, seeing differently. So the Dharma is also made up of skillful ways of seeing, skillful ways of looking at our experience. Because it's up to us how we see it. A breath doesn't have to just be getting air into the body, you know, getting air back out again, keep the heart pumping. You know, we're not just machines, but we can see it that way. Also, you know, you could say this is taking in the energy of the universe. You can see it that way. You know, many, many ways of seeing this experience. Why are we alive? What's life for? Yeah. There's no real meaning. There's no independent meaning for life. There's just ways of making life meaningful. Yeah. According to what moves you in this moment. What are you going to do with this wild and precious life? That's what Mary Oliver asked us in a poem. Yeah. What are you going to do with it? Is it precious? Oh, my life's not precious. Why is it not precious? It's the miracle of walking at all. Is it not wild? ever had a thought you plan to have? And they just pop up. Right? Those sensations we experience, they just occur. We're wild. Nothing more wild. To sit here and witness the wildness of the mind, the wildness of the body. So what are you going to do? And one definition of the Dharma can be meeting well. Drawing ourselves towards the middleness. This quality of heart and mind. So it's not so good, not good enough. It can go towards the outer world and it can go towards ourselves. Just watching that pattern, watching it unfold, and being very, very skillful. Just making sure that if we're drawn to teachings which talk about things like the emptiness of the self, yeah, deep side of these Buddha teachings is what is the self? Self is like this illusion we believe in, we fall for. But that can also draw that self-rejection side that was one of the extremes of the teachings. Oh yeah, I don't really exist. I don't really need to show up. It kind of appeals to that side of ourselves. And just check, is there warmth? Is there love in this kind of fading of the self-sense? Or is there a bit of a pushing away because we're not good enough? To be really clear, it's meeting well. And really that's what these teachings that we've been bringing into practice today is meeting the body. Yeah. Whatever's going on, the body is helping to reveal it. I think it's such a profound understanding. It should be really obvious to us, but I know for myself, it's like a teaching I had to learn to understand. That the stress, the tension that I'm experiencing now, part of that is because it's revealed in the body. And when I come into contact with that, it changes. Somehow it softens a little bit. We can actually meet this experience better. We can draw ourselves towards this middleness. It's not struggling so much. And so what the Buddha is offering to us is he's kind of laying out quite a clear but also a very delicate, subtle, and living path of practice to take on. That we're going to fall towards the extremes. So if you've been practicing today, I think Karen mentioned in the morning these hindrances that can come up for us. So where the mind goes, towards this pushing away, pulling towards momentum. And also, our energy will become out of sorts at times, you know, will become difficult for us. Restlessness, too much energy in the system. Or tiredness, you know, not enough energy in the system. And finding our ways to skillfully meet these is really a key part of our practice. And if we just take the kind of the greediness or the hatred momentums, can we actually meet these with like a holy disinterest, which isn't a rejection? You know, holy disinterest is a term my friend, teacher, Rob Babea came up with. This holy disinterest, where it's like a stance you take towards these things, that we're not building on top of. And so we can notice, I'm just wanting something. I'm wanting lunch, or I'm wanting something pleasant. It's not ultimately what I took birth for. Yeah, it's just a thing to get. And by recognizing that, it also attunes us towards more what might be meaningful, what we might really be interested in developing, or getting direct knowledge about, or towards awakening, or unbinding. Because we know it's not the transient pleasures that really bring meaningfulness to our life. Something else, something in the learning ways of meeting, I think kind of brings us more alive. And when the move of the mind is more aversive, more pushing away experiences, is it possible to bring more care and compassion into there, to use those opportunities as moments to practice the development of some really important heart skills? Yeah. Even if it's just towards a knee pain. Yeah. An ache in the body or an annoying thought that keeps coming back. Is there something that can be a bit more understanding towards this? A bit more loving towards the experience? This immediate feeling of pain, we push it away immediately, and then we don't want to be the one who's pushing away, and we push away that, and it can lead to these kind of chains of reactivity. But we can also just stop that chain at any point, and just say, oh yeah, this is what's happening. Maybe this is good enough. Maybe I can stop that. So what I like to remember in my practice is there's a middle way here. I'm just not seeing it yet. That's kind of the core reminder. There must be a middle way here. I'm just feeling, am I pushing something away? Am I pulling something towards me? Yeah. Is it possible just to stop that? To ease that, to soften it? In a way, what we're asking is, where is the tanha locating itself? Yeah. Is it in me? Is it in the world? Because it must be there somewhere. Because this is what is explained in these Four Noble Truths. And maybe this is the good time just to do the Greatest Hits album with my own personal remix. So, the first of these Noble Truths, we could say, as I say, this is a remix, this isn't straight from the Buddha's mouth, so you can head back to his original material later on. Let's presume that there is some dukkha happening right now. Okay? You're having an existence, let's just presume that there is some dukkha. Okay? I'm just going to agree to that. This is to be seen and understood. Yeah? Okay. I have some dukkha. I see it. I understand. I agree. You know, sometimes I imagine that the Buddha might come and kind of come to set us free from prison. And he's like, right, I've got the freedom plan, I've got everything here, and you're like, I'm not in prison, do you? You know? And he sees us in a prison that we don't ourselves see. So let's just presume, okay, I'm in prison. I'm in dukkha. I need to be set free. This saves time and gets us to the practice. Yeah, like the Buddha hasn't got time to explain to us how we got into prison and what's going on. We just agree, okay, I'm in dukkha. Help me. The second one is, that dukkha doesn't exist in a vacuum. Yeah, it's interrelated with other things. And one of the core things it's interrelated with is this tanha, yeah, which we've touched on. It's demanding this thirst for getting rid of stuff. Yeah. Becoming someone great. Which isn't a bad thing in itself, but just some of the ideas we have about what great means, it's questionable. And of course, it also isn't that tanha exists in a vacuum also. That's also has causes and conditions bringing it into being, yeah, one of which is ignorance. And one of the things that we're not aware of or we're ignorant of is how tanha and dukkha go together to create this whole mess of causing us to live in really unhelpful and extreme ways. So that's something it's worth bearing in mind. This understanding in itself softens tanha, softens dukkha, opens the gates, unbinds us. And the third point is that the conditioned arising of the dukkha experience, right, meaning that it arises because of other things, those are the conditions that bring it to come into being, means it's an avoidable experience. Yeah. It doesn't have to be this way. There's other ways of living. And here we're talking about the kind of psychological aspect of dukkha, what's sometimes referred to as the second arrow of dukkha. Yeah, the first arrow being there are painful experiences. Everything, everyone, including yourselves that you love, are going to die and leave. Ouch! That's first level, first arrow dukkha. The second arrow is that we turn around the arrow and shoot it into ourselves and say, I don't want that to be that way. Yeah? And that whole psychological aspect. Very avoidable level of dukkha. That life, they sometimes say, impinges on you. It hits you, yeah? Life's going to affect you. You're a sensitive being. You don't not want to be sensitive. Therefore, you are sensitive to pain. But this third quality of the Noble Truth is also talking about Nirodha, the cessation, the ending of dukkha. But it's also pointing towards the ending of the fading out of any phenomena at all. And this is a really remarkable part of the teachings, that the way we hold things in attention is a clasping, is a grasping, is a fixing. Yeah, it's a conception of things that we then hold on to. So this is quite a kind of a subtle part, and I don't really want to go too far into this Nirodha, Nibbana kind of aspect, but just to kind of label it out, because it's important to notice that there must be some kind of grasping going on if there's some kind of experience happening. So if you're experiencing something, even something very, very delightful, yeah, there's some bit of tanha, very, very subtle perhaps, even delightful compared to, you know, more grosser forms of it. You know, if we kind of have an experience of having had a complete meltdown, tantrum, mind-blowing, screaming kind of experience, and then we kind of tone it back down to anger, it's like, whew, that's a lot better. But we actually know, from anger I can come down to like, something, you know, kind of mindful. And then from mindful, I can bring it down to something very, 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 very quiet. And then maybe we can go even kind of quieter than that. Each of these, lessening and lessening of dukkha. As it becomes quiet, also these ideas we have about the world are starting to fade away. Yeah, this kind of self-referential treatment of experiences also doesn't seem to be bringing that much happiness. It kind of fades down again, fades and fades. This entire fading, this whole level of fading of experience is what this path is about, as a way of liberating us finally from this really self-cherishing, self-important sense. Yeah. And so when we pop back into experience again, we're popping back in with a really different sense. So we spoke yesterday about what Stephen Batchelor was saying, that the Buddha does for the self what Copernicus did for the earth. Yeah. So we don't have an earth-centered view of the universe anymore. And yet, you know, we might go outside and say, ah, the sun is rising. Ah, the sun is setting. Because we fall back into it, yeah. We fall back into thinking that, oh, the sun goes around the earth. Yeah. The earth goes around the sun. And we kind of deeply sense that because we have a map in our minds of the territory. And we can have a map in our minds of this self-territory, that it's optional to see through a lens that's so self-focused. We know that there's a range. We know that there's a spectrum. We know it goes up to tantrum and maybe beyond, yeah. Where does it go down to? What does it quieten down to? And that's kind of opening that exploration. So hopefully the Four Noble Truths Greatest Hits album remix is kind of getting going. So then we have the fourth, yeah. And it turns out the fourth is this path, this middle way path. And yeah, just let's quote the sutta again. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata? That producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, seeing things correctly, right view, right resolve, we could say right intention. Yeah. Underneath every action there's an intention. Before you move, yeah, before anything happens, there's intentions. The right resolve, right speech, that came in really early, huh? Right speech, the power of words. Freeing power of words, right speech. Wow. Right action, our conduct in the world, our sila, our morality, coming through in the way that we act. Right livelihood. Yeah? How we make a living in this world. How we relate to the community around us. Yeah, so this isn't just sitting on the cushion and checking your mind. Really about the way you live has an impact on consciousness. Really important to bear those things in mind. The right effort. When to bring energy. When to let go. The right effort. The right mindfulness. Yeah, that steadiness of attention. Can we stay with things? We need to stay with things because they are the things which we are present with. You can't ignore the things. But also, we want to stay with things because we're interested in this quality of their fading. We want to understand something which is called dependent origination, which is what these Four Noble Truths are talking about. What causes this, or what arises with this? Yeah. There's dukkha. What's with dukkha? Tanha. Ah, what's with tanha? Not seeing things clearly. Oh, yeah. And so there's this interplay between understandings and this path. And the mindfulness is really important. Wow, what's happening here? What is happening here? It's not the end of the path. None of it's the end of the path. It just goes around. The right mindfulness is going to support the right view. The right view, we hope, is going to set up the right intentions, which will support the right speech and right actions, and the right livelihood. And then there's the right samadhi, gathered, rightedness. And so this word right, yeah, I don't really like the word right. And it's a translation, yeah, of from the Pali. But I have more the sense of righted. And this is something you can say in English, and it also, it literally means that thing. So if you have a ship that's out at sea, you may not know this, or you may already know it, but like there's a lot of heavy weights in the bottom of the ship. Like if they haven't got a cargo, if they're not carrying stuff from one place to the other, they've got to have a lot of weight in the bottom of the ship. And it's actually that weight in the bottom of the ship that's pushing it down into the ocean, which is actually what keeps it afloat. And it's that stability. And so we need to be well grounded in our being. And that allows us to be upright. So I think the postures which we adopt for meditation are really helpful with that they ground us and they bring us up. A ship that hasn't got what's called a ballast, the weights weighing it down in the bottom of the ship, which is also called the hull, this technology, it's going to get knocked over, even by small waves. But one which is well weighted, even the bigger waves, you know, the big waves of grief, big waves of death, somehow there's some still really sensitive, still moved, but not turned over, not sunk by those. And these practices, I believe, are for that kind of quality of existence. So what would it mean to practice in tune with this, the Four Noble Truths, this dependent origination of experience? We mentioned one before. We're going to take the first noble truth. Yes, there is dukkha. Yeah. There's experience. Therefore, I know there must be some dukkha somewhere in some level. Yeah. So we had point number three. We could say, you know, if there's no dukkha, there's no experience occurring. So we know it's happening, and we know there must be some tanha operating in some way. And we can try it out for ourselves. What happens if I lessen the demand? I lessen the way of seeing this is not good enough. Does the dukkha also decrease? If I stop rejecting the pain in my wherever it is, does the suffering around it actually decrease? If I send love to a pain in my wherever it is that possible? What if I want to just get down to the level of sensations like we've been doing today? And we just come in there and we just feel them. It's different. It's a different experience. There's different ways of looking. So what reveals tanha? So we've been checking in with the body. Okay, what reveals tanha in the body? Anyone notice anything? Or dukkha? You know, tanha, dukkha, they co-arise. So is there something in the body that reveals it? Usually it's like a shrinking, yeah, or a clasping around. When we have pain, we actually do a very clever psychological thing, which I've heard explained a little bit like we try and keep the pain in one place. And so we actually clasp it, you know. It's like there's pain in the knee. Why doesn't that just spread everywhere? So it stays in the knee, and we kind of clasp around that area, kind of keeping it fixed in there. You're not going anywhere else, pain. You're just going to stay in there. The first thing that we experience on a bodily level, feels to me, the first layer that we experience is actually our resistance to the spreading of the pain. It's kind of caused like a crust like a case around the pain. But that's done by us. Yeah, that's kind of a psychological thing. And then, you know, we have that fix there. And then usually we either ignore it or we kind of obsess around it but not really come to it. Yeah, so we kind of like, it'll go. Or we can, I don't want it, but no. And we don't dive right in like we've been doing today. You know, just dive right in. What are the sensations actually? Is there movement? Is there heat? Is there temperature? All this kind of neutral language, actually. And that neutral language softens the tanha. Yeah? Oh, what's it actually like? Is it bubbly? You know? Is it moving around? You know, where are the edges? Oh, look, is it actually outside the body as well? It's bigger than the knee, isn't it? That's weird, isn't it? So it's like, it's got sensations which aren't inside the physical body. That's outrageous. And then, you know, we can get to know it in this way. But all of those getting to know softens the tanha. Now, when we're in the real throes of this, it's really important to see what else arises with that. And some of these we might miss. You know, we know that there are going to be thought patterns of not good enough. Yeah. But what are they going to be landing on? They're actually landing on this amplification of a sense of self. And that sense of self is also a sense of separation from. Yeah. Not one with everyone. It's just me. It's like a poor me kind of moment. I don't feel like a part of humanity. I just feel like this individual who's having a terrible time. And that sense of self kind of like inflates, gets bigger. And so if we talk about sense of self, which I wasn't really planning to do, it's just important to say that having like high self-esteem, thinking I'm brilliant, or low self-esteem, thinking I'm rubbish, both of those are amplified senses of self. Yeah, so that just to kind of clarify what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, you know, hey, fantastic me. And then this is like a whole other thing that doesn't belong in the Dharma. These are amplified senses of self. I'm great or I'm terrible. They go up. They really get louder when the tanha and the dukkha gets louder. A rigidity of concepts. This is a really fascinating one. The idea of what pain is becomes a very fixed thing. No, there's pain. Are you sure it's pain? Yes, I have pain. You know, have you really like checked it? Is it the same pain as you had before? Is it moving? It's this kind of fixedness. This is what I'm meeting. This is the way it is. And we could say like another aspect of that or the same thing from another side. It's like a kind of flatter perspective. Yeah. It's not like a variable landscape. It's like there's a thing. It's just this way. But it's everything has many sides, many ways of viewing it, many ways of entering towards it. So even if we try a practice and it doesn't really work, we can try other ways of contacting experience. And so as we amplify the sense of self, it also amplifies the sense of the object. You notice that something that really starts to get fully in our attention if we really want it, we really want to get rid of it. It really comes to the fore. The sense of self, sense of object, and sense of dukkha, they all arise together. There's a co-arising. So the sense of self, which appears like surely we're always ourself, yeah, or an object is always itself, they actually arise dependent on dukkha. And when dukkha fades, the sense of the object also fades, and the sense of the self also fades. And this is one aspect where it's really important that our mindfulness is good and clear. It's not just fading because you know, everything passes. It's fading because we're easing dukkha. So we can play with the arising and the falling of these experiences through the way we practice. So how are we going to bring this into a practice? Just a few last ideas and then we'll have a bit of walking, but we'll also open this into a practice tomorrow. So two really key ways. We've touched on them already. One is this idea of holy disinterest. So whatever's occurring to us, we can actually have a lot more equanimity. And so we just presume, okay, there's dukkha here. So when a phenomena comes into our attention, we think, ah, yeah, this is dukkha. And it's not a complaint, right? It's just an acknowledgement, right? It's not, oh, you're dukkha, get out of here, right? That's more rejection. Ah, it's actually a sense of, it can be just a sense of, you know, it's going to change. It's going to pass. It's not something I can rely on. If this is something I'm propping my sense of self on, you know, it's not going to be a reliable place to do that. And so we can work with this and notice that sense that we want something reliable. We actually want something reliable. Like, what's a quality you look for in a good friend? That they're really unreliable, right? Yeah. We all want really unreliable friends. And so we naturally seek the reliable. And recognizing, getting this bell off Karen at the end of the retreat is not going to be a reliable way for me to be happy. Because then I have to keep it, look after it, make sure, you know, I keep it from someone else taking it away from me. It can't bring me a lasting happiness. And also we know, we get bored. Yeah? I'm not going to be as into this bell even tomorrow as I am today. We don't follow down that pattern. We just see, oh yeah, lovely bell, it's dukkha. Not going to get attached, it's unreliable, won't bring me lasting satisfaction. Because maybe the lasting satisfaction is available, but it doesn't come from getting and getting rid of things. It's more like a natural state that comes from the middle way. So that first statement that the Buddha was making wasn't that don't have any enjoyment in your life, but don't go down the avenue of sensual pleasures and desiring, that's the desiring of things, temporary things, aren't going to get you there, this worldly way. And so, really clear, it's not a rejection. You know, just as if we notice that we're walking down the street and then we realize, ah, I'm actually going the wrong way down this street to get to where I'm heading. It doesn't mean that we've suddenly rejected walking or streets or even directionality. Yeah, we've just decided, oh, I need to turn around and walk the other way. Yeah. So we just see, ah, this is unreliable. This is dukkha. It's not a rejection. We just realize we're not heading in the right way for happiness. And because we typically seek in the wrong places for lasting satisfaction, this also isn't a depressing teaching, right? Because it's that there is possibilities for change. And actually, and this is perhaps like the weirdest line in the talk, it actually brings us joy, actually releases joy. It's a joyful practice to see that this is dukkha. Because we don't then clasp on, the sense of self softens, the sense of object softens, and as those things soften, just as moving from tantrum to anger to calm, we move into something that's really enjoyable to be in. Yeah, like opens, unbounds the feeling of love and well-being. And a second way that we can practice this is to do with the body. And this will be more the practice that we'll do tomorrow because it's less theoretical, yeah, and also less dangerous in that, you know, it's saying dukkha all day long. For some, might sound very depressing, and for others, would release so much joy that it would be a bit risky, a bit dangerous for us. So we're going to do this one of opening the contractedness. Yeah, so when we are experiencing distress, we shut down, we close down, we clamp down. And when we're, you know, having a good time or we're feeling what we would say, we're feeling open. Yeah. So it's kind of opening. So dukkha, a practice relating to dukkha as opening contraction. Like actually, what happens to your consciousness when you're in a really big landscape? Yeah, and your eyes take in this really vast expanse. You know, if you've only been inside small spaces for a while, what happens then? It's like the heart, the consciousness, the beingness, it spreads out to that wider space. And see if I can outdo the earlier weirdest statement of the retreat. But you have noticed that this room that you're sitting in is occurring inside of you. We're all objects in your consciousness. Now this talk is occurring in your consciousness. This is your conscious unfolding experience. And the more space there is that your consciousness is attuned to, like when you listen to the cars on the highway or the kind of subtle rural air, your consciousness immediately can expand out to there. When we're in distress, it automatically zooms in inside the skin, inside really kind of a tininess, and it's not enough space. And so just as the first way of practicing really softens the desire aversion hindrance, this actually opens out the sleepiness or agitation hindrance, because it's too much energy, yeah, and not enough space. And sometimes it's not enough energy in too much space. So we're actually playing with this vitality and openness, opening the range of what can happen for us. So both of these practices really rely on the principle that the way of relating to experience is the most important thing. It actually doesn't matter as much as we would normally think what experience we are having. Yeah? It doesn't actually matter if things appear to be going my way or not. What's really ultimately mattering is how am I meeting that? It's the spirit of creativity, playfulness, lightness. Phrase I like to remember is the possibility of possibilities. Yeah, there's another way of looking. There's a middle way here. Just haven't seen it yet. And those two practices can help us. Holy disinterest is one way. Opening. Open the consciousness. Open the body. Soften. Relax. Yeah. And tomorrow we'll bring those more and more into practice. So let's just have a minute of silence together to close the talk.